Welcome to Co-op Mode Reviews, a video game podcast where a bunch of us dudes and gals, whoever, come on that show, talk about a video game of their choice. I am Mike Espy, and I am joined by my two buddies who that are just perfect for this episode. With me is Trevor Froberg.
Hello.
And I am with, and beside me is Mr. Justin Sims.
Hi.
I don't know what the hell that was.
He is the creator of The Sims, and he's very super rich, and right now we're living in his mansion right now with his wonderful wife and his lovely little dog named Ellie. Very black lab. Was it black lab pit mix?
Sure.
Very vicious dog. Very vicious
pit bull.
Definitely the head of a pit. Really big mouth. So adorable. Just very lovely dog. And then we also have Kaz. We won't talk about Kaz, the cat. He's just an asshole. Anyway. So today is very awesome because we dive back into the 90s once again. And we are talking about another what is perceived to be a classic amongst Final Fantasy fans, the Super Nintendo fans, and that is Final Fantasy VI. So what I want to kick it off is, what is your history with this game? Like, how did you two come about this game? Because I'm going to just be upfront. This is my first time playing it, and I never owned a Super Nintendo as a kid. I was a Sega Genesis kid at the time, and let's just say I'm a late bloomer to the game where I bought an official Super Nintendo back in 2017. So I'm a proud owner of that. And
congrats.
Yeah. And Trevor will be very proud of me. I own a PVM and I use a SCART connection, and my scan lines are fucking fantastic.
I bet it's probably one of the best experiences for Super Nintendo.
Oh my God, it is. I'm nerding out over it. And my
man, are you going to be disappointed when you learn how I played this game?
So to start off with those questions, Justin, what is your history with Final Fantasy VI? How did you come about it? Was it a friend, family? What drew you to the game? And based off, if I'm correct, you've had multiple playings with it, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
I guess to go back a little bit further, I was about 8 years old when we got our first NES. Mm-hmm. And so I played the first Final Fantasy on that.
Oh, wow.
And that was like the third game that I had ever played.
That was torture, right?
Well, I didn't understand it at all.
Yeah.
So I had the book. So I still didn't understand it, but I was getting through it. So then a few years later, I'm 12-ish, and I had an SNES, and my older sister's boyfriend at the time had this amazing game called Final Fantasy III, which is Final Fantasy VI. And he knew that I liked the first one, so he let me borrow it. And by borrow it, I mean, I think I kept it for about a decade.
Wow.
And so I played it a lot, beat it at least twice over that 10-year period. Kind of kept coming back to it, play other games, come back to this one, realize I don't know where I am in the story, restart it. Just kind of how it goes with a lot of RPGs, especially when you're, early teenager and your attention span is very small.
Oh.
And most recently, I did play it last year on my phone. So I end up, I played Final Fantasy 1 and Final Fantasy 6 kind of back to back because I hadn't played either of those games in about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And really just kind of wanted to live through some nostalgia, and I had some downtime at work. And it's kind of amazing because with this one, there's a decent amount of grinding, right? With any RPG that you're playing.
Right.
And the fast forward feature that you can have now helps so much. Just like going through the like the dinosaur forest in Final Fantasy VI just to level up people and use relics or use espers,
mm-hmm,
to teach everyone magic and get as high as I can before I can defeat Kefka.
Oh, man. Well, I'm kind of jealous of the fast forward feature, but I wouldn't trade it just because I wanted to say I had not in like a pompous sense, but like I had the original experience, you know, that sort of thing. Like,
I mean, I had the original experience just 20 years ago too.
Oh yeah. Well, there's, yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And I had that experience because there was times where I sat there going, I went there like, ah, random encounters. Oh boy. Deep breath, deep breath, deep breath. But still fun. Trevor.
So I have an older brother, Andy. He's 2 years older than me. Knew a friend. I was in second grade. He was in fourth grade. And we went over to his friend's house. His name was Will. And Will was like, hey, my brother's got these video games. And he's got Final Fantasy IV and Final Fantasy VI. We're going to be getting it soon. They didn't quite have it. I think this was... I'm trying to think.
It came out in 94.
It came out in 94. I would have been in second grade. And they would have been... So I don't think they... I don't know if it quite... If it hadn't quite come out yet or if they just hadn't picked it up. And so when they finally got it, they're like, you got to see this game. This is a game you've never seen before. And then I saw the title sequence and I was like, what is this? This is... this is interesting, but the logo I thought was cheesy at the time. You hear the...
Yeah, yeah,
and the logo's on fire, and I was like, I don't get it. And then they started playing it, and he was at just getting past the Returner's hideout in the World of Balance. So that was my first experience with it. I borrowed it from him. I played through it, and I played through quite a bit, and then I used a Game Genie because I was like, oh, this will be cool. Problem with a Game Genie on a Super Nintendo is it has a chance to corrupt games. So it raced his older brother's game because he was at the last save point before you go to the tower through the three statues or whatever.
So when I was younger, I never actually finished the first Final Fantasy because it wasn't because I was using a Game Genie, but like three times right before you fight the final boss Chaos, it like I used a house saving outside the main cave and I'm gonna go in, game corrupted.
Oh no.
And so I just gave up, right?
Because yeah.
I hate everything. I've already went through this game three times and said screw it. So I finally beat it, you know, as a very mature adult on my phone.
There you go. Right, right. So I borrowed it and I played through most of the game. I never beat it. But then I finally bought the cartridge a couple of years later for myself, played through it, beat it. That was elementary school, probably 96, 97. I was probably 9 or 10.
That was the year the 64 came out, right? 97 or something like that?
Somewhere, 96.
96,
September,
right.
96. And so I ended up beating it. And then they came out with the re-release for PlayStation.
Right.
Because it was bundled with... Was it bundled with Chrono Trigger? Or was it bundled with Final Fantasy V?
I think it might have been bundled with the Final Fantasy games. I don't recall ever seeing it bundled with Chrono Trigger.
There were two of them that were bundled. It was Final Fantasy V. There were four of them that were released. Two of them that were bundled in different ways. It was Final Fantasy IV, 6, 5, and Chrono Trigger.
Interesting.
I don't remember what the bundle is. Anyway, long story short, played it, you know, randomly throughout. I probably beat it two or three times, played through it probably five or six because I would get tired of grinding and then quit and then not know where I was, just like Justin. So
interesting.
Yeah.
So I actually got my story with it is that I always heard it through the grapevine, read online, and in terms of like when I'm being I guess you'd say I consider myself collecting or a collector to some degree of that definition. But I started going through like, okay, some of the top Super Nintendo games that one should own, buy, whatever. And of course, Final Fantasy III in America, Final Fantasy VI in Japan. Somehow we missed several iterations of that back then. And that was one where I was like, yes, that's the one I really need to get my hands on. So I went on eBay, of course. eBay is the best, the places of all places to find used stuff of whatever you want. Just used stuff. That's a bad way of describing it, but I know. And I completely oblivious to the artwork or the font and everything, what should be on that cover.
I remember this.
And I bought the game, and I was like, man, this seems to be relatively cheap for a very popular game. And then I noticed something interesting about the cartridge. It was a lot smaller than my other Super Nintendo cartridges, because I bought it from Chris, our friend Chris Lowe. I bought Zelda: A Link to the Past and Super Mario World, and I'm thinking, perfect. Like if you were a kid back then in the 90s, that was like mind blown, man.
Right.
Hours spent. And then I was like comparing the size of the cartridges, and I go, man, this one is smaller, like really smaller. And then I noticed something else.
Did you get the Game Boy Advanced version or something?
No, I got a repro version. And the thing is, what really threw me, like, what was like, not only the size of the cartridge, but the sticker was kind of peeling off too. And I was like, And then the screws were plastic. The screws are plastic. And I go, and then I looked at, you know, official Nintendo cartridges. Nintendo cartridges are not, they don't use plastic screws. They use metal screws or whatever, copper or of anything. So that's where I started doing another deep dive into, you know, what's considered to be authentic, what's considered to be a reproduction. And so I found out that when I opened up the inside, it looked like a stick of RAM, when in fact it should look kind of like a really kind of like a decent-esque chip / motherboard looking thing. And it should have like a C, and it should have a CMOS battery soldered onto it, because that CMOS, yep, that's it. Yes, that CMOS battery allows you to save your game.
It's a big game.
Yeah, that thing allows you to save your game. So that is the original one that I got from Twitter. And that story was, is like, Twitter? So I was some group, I got lumped into this group, and I was just talking with them. And I made a joke about, like, you know, I had a bad day because I bought a reproduction cartridge of Final Fantasy VI. You know, I was being half-heartedly sarcastic, but I was like, I was still bummed out that I bought a repro. And the guy's like, well, this has been sitting on my shelf for a very long time. I'll, you know, you can have it. And I go, are you joking? He was like, no, I'll do it. I'm dead serious. And he showed me like a video of this, and he's like, I'll put in this package right here and send it to you. I was like, okay, I did that. And lo and behold, several days later, in comes a cartridge of Final Fantasy VI in the mail. Open that sucker up, and it was the original thing. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
That's amazing.
This is amazing right now. I got a game that's probably worth maybe $100 on the eBay market because of rarity for free. So no complaints there. So it's pretty rad. It is fucking rad. So that's my story with getting that game and then finally playing through it for the first time, which is amazing. But the one thing I want to tackle about is, especially these older games that we obviously have a value to, especially nostalgic value. But the one question I always like to ask myself when I go back and play these games, do you really like these games because, especially this one, this one in particular, do you enjoy it because it's not nostalgic, or do you think the game itself actually holds up until through 2021 right now? What aspects about it, like, do you find still hold up, and what would you say it's like nostalgic about it? Or do you think it's just like, no, it's not one of those games. They boot it back up, and it's like, it's not this, you know, it's not the same anymore.
I used to be an elitist about, like, well, if you don't grind your characters, or if you don't grind in a JRPG or any RPG, like, you're not playing it right. Like, if you
fast forward, you're not playing it right.
If you aren't, you know, going through that trouble, you know, it's that saying of, like, I'm going to butcher it, but it's something like, well, if you haven't like gone through the pain of like experiencing that, mm-hmm. then somebody help me out. It's like, you don't understand. You don't get it. Whatever. I apologize. I'm bad at butchering things. Poorly at butchering everything. Anyway,
you're bad at butchering things.
That's
good.
Good at butchering things. I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, regardless, the biggest thing is, I was like, oh, if you don't grind, then you're not playing a good JRPG or whatever.
Right.
And then as I've gotten more grown up, I'm like, I don't have that time
right
to sit there and grind for hours to get my magic up, to get my skills up, yada, 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 to be strong enough. So I get why a lot of RPGs nowadays, the grinding is really not existent because you're going through the storyline.
Right.
So I would say that that doesn't hold up.
Right. And then, is that mainly due to the fact that it's random encounters, or is it just the grinding overall? Because we play Chrono Trigger, and the thing, the big difference between Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI is that Chrono Trigger, you actually see the enemies on screen, so therefore you can actually dodge and not have to fight at all in a certain area. This is a year after Final Fantasy VI, and I saw that, I think that Square Enix kind of got wind of like trying something else new. Instead of like random encounters, let's just do, you know, here's the enemies on screens, there's certain types and so on and so forth, and kind of almost make it streamlined as possible. But this is back to the bare, what, when I think of JRPGs, I think of random encounters. So do you think is that the case, or?
I don't know. I don't, it doesn't bother me. I don't think random encounters bother me. Maybe because I've lived through it. Again, like it's going back to the, well, I, you know, endured it. It's fine.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't know.
I'm trying to think of modern RPGs that I've played, because unfortunately I haven't played any of the new Final Fantasies. So I don't necessarily know like how much grinding is involved in modern games.
I don't think there is that much. I think
just story related and you're leveling up as the story goes.
I think after like 7, I feel like you didn't have to grind nearly as much as you did on the Super Nintendo ones. I think 8 and 9,
a lot of 10. Yeah, you didn't have to.
Yeah.
That, I don't think. Either that or I'm blocking it out.
Right. I don't think you had to as much. But they had different, you know, magic systems.
Right.
Which changed it.
So
significantly, in my opinion.
Well, one of my things is that when I look at game mechanics, and especially the evolution of, especially from the graphical standpoint, because it felt like the 2D era was a short period of time before the making the jump to 3D. It was like almost like 4 or 5 years before we officially decided to go, okay, we're done with 2D. Now we're on to the next big thing, which is 3D, PlayStation, Nintendo 64. But then now that I think about it, I go, some of the game mechanics were still very much the same. They were turn-based. But in the infancies of 3Ds and 3D, it felt like things felt a little more cinematic, but the gameplay itself was still relatively the same, you know. So, and even then with modern games nowadays that try to mimic that sort of thing, so it's like that tells me there's must have been something during this era that this game mechanic is still standing the test of time. Or do you feel like it's just something that it's what we only remember, what we know? But I still feel like when I look back at the eras that we've gone through in terms of the evolution of gaming, turn-based, everyone doesn't have to like it, so it's to each their own, but turn-based attacks feels like it still is like almost, dare I say, timeless. It has nothing to do with the graphical aspect of anything. It's just, it is a gameplay mechanic that actually still feels like it could be applicable to any game, you know, any era of game. So that's what makes me wonder then, is it because of the gameplay mechanic one of the things that make Final Fantasy VI stand, you know, do you feel like it stands the test of time? Because everyone keeps talking about this particular entry the most, any article I've read, you know, 1 through 5, they're like, yeah, that's fine. 6, like, it's like, holy shit, 6 for some reason is the thing. 7, of course, because it was one of the, dare I say, revolutionary games at the time, because it was introducing 3D graphics and it was a lot more cinematic. So that game in of itself for that part had that going for them. So would you feel like 6 alone at this point is still standing the test of time? And if so, do you think gameplay mechanics is one of those reasons?
I'd say yes. I mean, just as I play D&D, and all the battles in that are turn-based, So I feel like, you know, that's something that's been around for...
Since the 80s? Is that 80s?
Yeah. 83? Is that when it started?
Mm-hmm.
Which Final Fantasy definitely lifted a ton from D&D.
Well, no doubt.
Yeah. But, you know, when you're going back to Final Fantasy 1, that was 100% turn-based. I really like this one because it uses the active time battle thing. So everyone has their own individual bar. So somebody could end up getting more attacks than other characters. And I think that's really interesting. And when putting together my notes and everything for this, it made me wonder if there was a way to be able to do that within D&D. Just if you had a faster character who hits not as hard, if it was a practical sense.
Right.
Sorry, I'm...
No, that's fine.
I'm detracting. But, I mean, yeah, I still think that holds up 100%, just like you said. I think it's something that started back in the 80s and then still holds true because it gives everyone kind of equal weight.
Mm-hmm.
But still allows for strategy and still allows for... I think it one of the ways that it helped me, especially as a kid, is if you're not necessarily fast enough,
mm-hmm.
then you don't... It's not necessarily how quick you're hitting the succession of buttons.
Right.
Turn-based, it's really just like, all right, well, this is the character that's up. This is what I think I want to have them to do.
And right.
Ideally, you do it. Now, if you're doing a blitz with Saban and you hit the wrong key command, you still screw yourself. But, you know, ideally, that's a rarity.
Well, I think Final Fantasy VI really helped evolve the active battles. Because you look at, like, you know, if you do the blitz and you mess it up, you just lost your turn.
Yeah.
If you're using Cyan, you got to wait for his sword tech to go up.
You could be attacked multiple times, which...
Right.
Which I kind of dug when I played this.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what helps is as games evolve and as technology evolves, I didn't play Final Fantasy XII, but I watched my roommate in college play, and it looked like they still do the attacks in a turn-based fashion, but there's a little bit more strategy where you kind of like pick and choose orders and stuff like that ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
and then modify them or something.
Right.
I'm not 100% sure, but I feel like they, you know, with Final Fantasy VII, you get your limit break, and all of a sudden, boom, that character's, you know, right there to attack ready right now.
Right, right.
I feel like there's different evolutions that allow it to be fresh and interesting while still maintaining the basis of the time-based the attacks or the turn-based, sorry.
Yeah. So I think it's safe to say, and we're in agreement when it comes to turn-base, that that is, I think it still stands true. Now, one of the interesting things about... I will get to the characters later because I feel like that's another strong aspect. As many characters there are, as many characters there are in this game, I feel like with a few of them, with an exception, and I'm actually willing to forgive, that you get to learn these characters along the way. And, you know, I said that I clocked in about 60 hours into this game, and surprisingly, with all the amount of traveling you do with these characters, you get to learn more about them in different encounters that they have. Now, one of the things I find to be very interesting is the very opening sequence of this game. And the reason why I think what really hooked me was that coming from a film background, I was watching this opening sequence as if it was, you know, I was like, I'm going to try to view this in a point of a film. It's sweeping landscapes, showing environments, and I feel like the text that are coming on screen is like a VO. And then you're going through all these environments. You're explained that the setting is like the ancient... So the setting, basically, this is from the intro. The ancient war of the Magi, when its flames at last receded, only the charred husk of a world remained. Even the power of magic was lost. In the 1,000 years that followed, iron, gunpowder, and steam engines took place of magic, and life slowly returned to the barren land. Yet there now stands one who would reawaken the magic of ages past and use its dread power as a means by which to conquer all the world. Could anyone truly be foolish enough to repeat that mistake? And then it sets you up with these two soldiers, and then are the main character, Terra. They're in these mech suits, and they're, you know, looking over this vast tundra land. And I felt like when I was watching this, I go, why does this feel like, I go, this is 2D, this is 1994, and I feel like how it's presenting itself, in a way, it's almost kind of cinematic, because when I read, when you read the text on screen and then how it shows these two characters, I'm like, okay, you're guiding me into this direction, you're directing me in this path. And then it fades to black and I go, interesting. And then the music starts kicking up, and that first piece of mute, that's probably the second or third piece of music, I can't remember the operation of that, kicks in, and you're just watching these mechs walk across this tundra, and the music kicks in, and the beginning credits start to roll. And I just remember thinking, like, holy shit, like, this is kind of epic. Like, this feels like I'm going on an epic adventure. And this is within the first 5 minutes of the game. And that is when I sat there thinking to myself, I don't want to skip this. I'm going to let this roll through the whole sequence, because the music itself alone, I mean, I'm not a music aficionado, but I got to say the music in this game is just fucking fantastic. And the way it opens up, it makes you feel like you're going on an adventure. And I do think wholeheartedly, you got to be able to capture your audience's attention within minutes. Because if I feel like if you don't, and this may not be true, but for everything, but I do wholeheartedly believe if you really want to capture their attention within 5 to 10 minutes, you need to set something up, and to an extent, to really keep them engaged. And that opening sequence, I wholeheartedly believe, without even getting into the action just yet, it's just dialogue, it's just text on screen, scrolling imagery, and then the music kicking on, I felt like no ounce of gameplay it was there. And I remember sitting there going, okay, already 5 minutes into this, this already feels cinematic. Okay, I'm already 100% in already. This is like, that's a good, just that walking sequence alone. It's like, it's just a walking cycle of them going through the tundra. And I felt like the developers, the director must have had so much confidence at that point in time that they knew for some, maybe they didn't know, but they just had a lot of confidence in their product at that moment and just said to themselves, no, we know what we're doing, and it's going to be great. It's just going to be great. And I still think that it's one of my favorite moments in the game. It's just that opening sequence. Cause I go, you want to take me on an adventure? You're already setting me up. I'm fucking amped for it, man.
So take yourself back to the early and mid 90s. Name another game that made you feel like this.
Or that had like a cutscene that long.
Right. That the emotion that you felt immediately, you're like you said, I'm all in. I'm mm-hmm. connected. I'm here. I'm now.
Right.
I'm doing this. I can't name another game that I felt that emotionally attached to in the mid 90s. Not even Final Fantasy VII. I liked Final Fantasy VII. I didn't love Final Fantasy VII. The only game I could think of that maybe I emotionally felt that attached to was maybe Super Metroid. But even then, that's such a far stretch. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm in love with Samus Aran. Mm-hmm. But she's also just like, that's just such a great game.
Right.
I can't think of another game that brought me like that.
I got nothing, man.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, for years, I've said that this was my favorite game. It kind of just became the default for years if people would ask, like, what's your favorite video game?
Yeah, because I think we discussed this at WFFT when we were together. And they were like, Final Fantasy VI, for sure. but I think you're dead on. I mean, I don't think there was ever a game to this point that maybe had this kind of storyline and production and value that really drew that person in and changed how they felt about a game as attached to the character development. Because like you said, there's no action. Mm-hmm. There's no gaming. There's nothing going on.
Right.
You haven't done anything except watch. And you're drawn in.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even in, I don't think that's even in Secret of Mana because that came out the year before. And I'm playing that. I'm also playing that right now. I'm crazy to go from one. It's actually not a turn-based game, fun fact, which is really surprising, but still kind of cool in that way. Made by the same company. Well, they were called Squaresoft then, now Square Enix. But even then, that game had at least the music really captivated your attention. And I just remember thinking all how the view on music, especially from the 8-bit and the 16-bit, people will always make fun. It's like, oh, it's all those bleep, 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 bloops. And, it's that silly jargon. Right, and some of them can be just that. They can be. But I, as someone who, one of my things when it comes to video games or in film, the one thing I always actively search for, does this have a soundtrack I can listen to? I want to know what this component, because I feel like it's always overlooked or people just don't really pay much, you know, they just don't pay enough attention to it. I don't know what it is, but I started getting more into soundtracks as I got older because I wanted to know the other element as to how it makes me feel and then, you know, how it makes me feel at that moment and then how does it make...
Whoa, what was that?
Oh, cat food. Time?
All right. and then how does it make me feel when I play the game itself? So what I did was I listened to the music before playing this game and just, I remember thinking that opening, I got chills and I go, okay, I want to see how this compares to the actual visuals. And then the visuals came on. I was like, oh God, this is amazing. This is just in fucking incredible. So I, what?
Oh, now I wanted to go back to what Trevor said when he first played this game and you saw Final Fantasy III come up on screen and the text was on fire and he said it looked really cheesy. Like, how do you feel now when you're looking back at it?
I get goosebumps. I get goosebumps because I'm like, I'm about to go through this journey again. I understand, you know, the aspect of everything's on fire. Nothing is great in this game. You know,
it's so textural compared to, like, I feel like everything we were playing back then, too. Oh, you're talking absolutely. Super Mario World and everything's round and colorful and bright. And then you pop it in Final Fantasy III, and it's so gritty.
Uh-huh. It's very gritty. It's got a very intentional logo. The way it appears, mm-hmm. the way it's on fire, the way you get to it. You got that dark music, and you're just like, I don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off in a dark. Everything's dark from the very get-go. I don't think you get light until... Me, I don't know.
I can't remember when
you're like searching the world once you're outside of that town and outside that cave.
I think so. I think a little bit there
because it's a lot of blues and it's a lot of blues, browns, and grays in terms of the color palette. Because you are in the essentially you're in Narsh, I believe you're in Narsh for the most part within the very beginning, and the only person that has any resemblance of brightness to them is the main character. Where we start out with Terra, and that then you meet Locke, who's also donning more blue gear, whites and browns and all that stuff. So you're now that you brought that to my attention, the color palette in comparison to a lot of games, like I'm think of what I have in my collection right now, Donkey Kong Country, very bright oriented game. Super Mario World is a very bright game. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I have that too, so that's a very intentional. I think out of those games, out of my list, even Secret of Mana is a very bright game. So to have Final Fantasy 3/6, call it whatever you want, but it's really, really 6. It really, the color palette is almost, dare I say, muted. It's nowhere near to the color palette as to the games I just mentioned or what was previously, I wholeheartedly believe that what was on the shelves. And so for me to have like almost like a felt very opera, like if that's what it felt like. I mean, that's when it's like organs, and that's what I associate those organs. I associate like with a very opera, like and very, very melodramatic.
Don't mix Phantom of the Opera.
I'm talking about organs. Okay.
That's a musical. Okay. Not an opera.
Trevor.
I'm sorry.
Trevor. I love you very much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all I had to say.
Kind of going back to sound though.
Yeah.
Like besides just the music, I loved a lot of the sound effects, especially when Celeste is, when you're going back to the opera, when Celeste is actually on the stage and you can kind of hear her singing, but it's just like the high pitches in the 16-bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like I totally believe it. Kefka and his deep laugh.
Iconic. It's those attention to details that always make me think that perhaps that when people do talk about this game, and I'm gonna keep going back to this point, that perhaps that it is standing the test of time, and it's 2021, it came out 1994, so let's do math.
27.
So that 27 years, that's crazy. That's crazy that this, so far, 27 years, that this game is still having that lasting impact. So it's kind of, it also makes me just believe, it's more like this was like a research for me. So, you know, first time experience, but also I'm trying to be a little bit more analytical as well to gain a better understanding of these games that I missed as a kid. And I know as a kid, I would not have ever appreciated because a lot of my collection of games involved side-scrolling. It was just a lot of beat-em-ups, you know, platformer games, and my attention span was nowhere near as it is right now. Terribly short. Just, okay, just awful. Just awful, terrible span. I just would not appreciate... Mike in 1994 would not have liked this game. I guarantee you that right now.
Okay, so to tail on that, you play a lot of modern video games.
Mm-hmm.
You keep up with a lot of gaming community, gaming everything.
Right.
More so than I have in the past 10 years. What was your overall experience, just in general, standing the test of time? I might be getting a little bit too broad.
Yeah. You didn't get the nostalgia factor.
Yeah, you didn't get the nostalgia factor.
No.
Because I think Justin and I, that plays a huge role into this, and we're going to be biased regardless of how analytical we get.
Right. So for me, when it comes to nostalgia factor, the example I can bring up wholeheartedly is Sonic the Hedgehog. I played that game a ton as a kid. I have deep admiration for Sonic 3 plus Sonic and Knuckles because even then I had found out back then as a kid that was supposed to be one whole game, but it was too big for one cartridge. So they came out with Sonic 3 and Sonic and Knuckles. And so to kind of get that full story experience, you had that flip lid, that lid that could flip open and attach Sonic 3 on top of Sonic and Knuckles. And then you got everything.
You could play them both. At the same time, like
they lead, one leads into the other. It's like literally after Sonic 3 ends, it immediately goes right into Sonic and Knuckles. It's like a direct sequel.
I don't want to sidetrack too much, but did they just do sprite replacement?
It was the same. It's like it was a Sonic and Knuckles were the same sprites from Sonic and 3. Everything else was because all the levels in that game, new enemies too, and all that. So that was all completely new in comparison to Sonic 3. But as far as I can tell, Sonic was the same sprite and so is Knuckles.
Because couldn't you put Sonic 2 in it?
I think you could.
And you could play Sonic 2 as Knuckles.
Yes, I think so, yeah. And so those sprites looked very different because the first two Sonic games kind of almost had like, they were kind of going for like a semi-3D ish look, whereas Sonic 3 felt more like it was kind of more hand drawn in comparison to the two.
Yeah.
So,
sorry, I didn't mean to.
No. No, it's totally fine because I remember going, yes, it does. It does look kind of like clay esque. Like it looks like it, like you can kind of touch it with your hands. Whereas Sonic 3, it looks like you could definitely tell they felt like they were more penciled in. But to me, that game, I find is like a lot of nostalgic factors because as a platformer, it's okay. But at the same time, you have a character supposed to go really fast, but which doesn't make it really sense if you're hopping from one platform to another. So you have like this supposed to be who's supposed to be like this incredibly fast character. And yet I'm being constantly blocked by these obstacles, which kind of defeats the purpose of being a really, really fast character in general. And sometimes levels, at least from many times I played it, I did not have a good succession of going through the level unharmed or untouched or super fast at all. But I sometimes didn't want to go really fast because it's like, well, what if I miss one of those big rings that I want to get the Chaos Emerald? So it's like, you have all, it felt like it had all these elements happening in here. And it's like, this, and then I sit there and go, this doesn't really make any sense now. But I still, I like popping it in because I can it draws me back to a time where like I felt like, you know, just like it made me feel like a kid. But not necessarily the game mechanics alone. It's just that I just know when I pop this game in, I go, oh, I feel like, you know, 8-9-year-old Mike. You know, like there's, that's about it. That's as like nostalgic factor is. So I don't think Sonic the Hedgehog really stands the test of time. But it's not to say that I won't pop it in every now and then and play it, because I like that feeling of, you know, being a kid again. Whereas when we come back to here, I'm seeing elements that I don't find to be like, yes, you could have those connections as a kid, but I don't, from what we're talking about here, and from how I'm, at least from my perspective, I don't see it to be a just complete nostalgia factor. I feel like at that time, Squaresoft had really was honing in on these game mechanics that were just, whether or not they knew it, but it was going to stand the test of time. And with those game mechanics, I felt like, you know, you had to be attached to characters too. And that's another aspect as well. Like Sonic the Hedgehog was just like, you know, kind of like this, I'm this tough attitude kid, you know, this tough attitude. Like, and, you know, that's what made it cooler than Super Nintendo. Who wants to play that wimpy Mario bright ass dude? Who wants to be that character who's got all the ad? Who has the tude, man? Who's got the tude? You know,
that's a very 90s kids thing to say.
Yes, I know, right? You're right, right? So that's, you know, to me, that's what I think of nostalgia, man. Like that's how I view nostalgia. It brings back a time. It certainly can bring back a time where you feel like a kid, but that's where it's like complete nostalgia for me. That is complete nostalgia for me. Turtles in Time has nostalgic factor, but that beat 'em up mechanic and how long you are in levels, the music, the characters you get to choose, they have different movesets, that it's, even though it's a button masher, it still holds up. It still holds up to this very day. And it's like, this game came out in the mid early 90s, and yet here I am still enjoying it. And one of the things I want to circle back to, one thing is, I know we're traveling all over the floor, but did I answer your question?
It was kind of like as a person who's never played the game before, right. Do you feel like in general, did it quote unquote stand the test of time?
Yeah, 100%. With the exception of random encounters, that's just the exception of random encounters.
Well, back in my day.
Yeah. Random encounters and inventory management was a thing that really stands
out. Inventory management? Your inventory was infinite, is what it felt like. You just put random shit in there and.
Yeah, I know.
And then when you get Shadow, you just throw it.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, that's what I mean. Like, I encountered that with Castlevania Symphony of the Night, where I felt like I was collecting a bunch of items, and it's like, I have a bunch of shit in here right now.
Yeah, you just gotta let it go.
Yeah,
and it's, then any sword you throw,
pretty much sword that I'm not using, I just throw it.
Right.
Yeah, I get it. But aside from that, what seems to be a very 90s thing, everything else about it doesn't feel like it's I don't feel like it's bound to the era of the 90s. I don't feel like it's bound to the era of 2D or 16-bit graphics. I don't feel like it's bound to that at all.
Because I think as anybody who's competent in storytelling will agree, is that a good story is timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what they did here, is they developed characters that you could connect with. You got to see their backgrounds. You got to see where they're at, how mm-hmm. they're feeling.
Yeah.
You got to see parts of the plot, parts of their characters that didn't advance the plot.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to say, I was watching a YouTuber named Pro Jared talk about the opera scene.
Mm-hmm.
Why? it's not really necessary other than they were using Celeste to woo Setzer.
Mm-hmm.
But this opera scene is drawn out. But if you look at how Celeste is feeling, she's kind of embarrassed to be this opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
She's a badass general for the emperor, the
right.
empire.
Right.
And now she's got to go out there and be this feminine character and sing these feminine love lines about her heart being broken. Right. And she starts showing vulnerability. And then she starts wondering, is Locke really talking to me, or is he trying to replace his feelings for Rachel?
Right.
And so you get this deep emotion connection that I didn't get as a kid. I probably didn't even get it in college when I played this game. But when this guy was talking about it, I was like, that's a good point. There's a lot of these storyline elements, or character elements rather, that are deep, that you can connect on even at a little bit of a level. Mm-hmm. You can understand them. And I think that's what makes a good story, is being able to connect with characters.
And that's why I kind of like with this, in the essence of Chrono Trigger as well, where I did not feel like it was bound to a certain era of time. I felt like I wholeheartedly believe that this was just people just trying to tell developers and this company that they were just trying to tell a story about, you know, characters that we can on some level connect with. And, you know, that was interesting that another character, one of the random craziest characters in here, Gao, who's very primitive. I think I was going to say like almost caveman-esque, but he's very primitive.
Right.
But there was a moment where he was trying to impress his dad. Was his dad or grandfather?
I think it was his dad.
I think it was his dad. But the crazy thing is that he was like, they went all through this effort to like spruce him up a little bit, you know, make him a little bit more presentable. And even when I can't remember who was in my party who did that, but that's not the point. But basically these characters, whoever you're with, really try to help him out and get him to be,
Saban and Cyan, right?
I think so.
It's at the end of them going through the Imperial base.
Right. Yes. But his dad does not recognize him at all. And it's like this character I hardly use, who's talked like kind of like jargon, like very below basic English language, is like having this moment where my dad does not recognize me at all. Even, you know, he's like, maybe I look too crazy or something, you know? And then he tries to actually speak proper, like proper English. And his dad still doesn't recognize him. And I remember sitting there going, like, Jesus Christ, like, I was not expecting this to happen at all. Like, I wasn't expecting the Celeste moment to happen. And there was another moment with Celeste, too, where it was a big, it is definitely a spoiler, but she jumps off a cliff because she was trying to kill herself. I was like, excuse me? Is this happening? Like, what? And so it was really fascinating to see like moments with these characters. I don't want to spoil it all of them, but I think that's what it is about here. And especially with Cyan, and I'll just say the ghost train. And this is what I really enjoy about this game, that you're really having these genuine moments with the characters that you can connect with. And that no matter the level of absurdity that this game does in terms of art design and who you like face as enemies, because you face a ghost train. It's like,
did you suplex it?
I did.
Right.
Yeah.
When I had that chance, I was like, I'm doing that. And I did it. I was like, this is fucking absurd. So in regards to one of the other moments that I thought off the top of my head was like the is the train with Cyan, which is the ghost train. And I think when we're talking about absurd moments where games be in the game, but yet it's still it's touching upon an emotional beat, and that is in, I won't go into too much detail, but that's in relation to his family. And so it's really interesting how this game, I find that Final Fantasy to me in a way, it's like, I'm like, well, Final Fantasy will always be Final Fantasy. And what I mean by that is like, it will always have like the most intricate, most unique art design that I see on screen. I know it's going to be kind of over the top, but what I also, what I wasn't expecting was to have these type of emotional connections with these characters. So the balance of like, you have these basically character development and over the top, I guess you would say action bits. So these, so one of my biggest takeaways from this game is that,
sorry. He's staring me down.
For those listeners here, the cat's on the table and just totally hissed and swiped at Trevor. Don't worry, he has no claws, so he's defenseless. He just thinks he's tough, but really the cat's just an asshole. So that's that story about there.
This cat's going to be my BFF by the end of the night.
I've lived with him for 10 years and he's still not my BFF.
I salute you, Trevor. Best luck on your endeavors.
Look at that glare.
Oh, Jesus Christ. This cat is like really pissed off for our listeners right now. He does not give two shits what's happening right now.
Yes. Never mind. Kaz!
That wasn't me.
He's going to come swiping at you like this asshole.
I had a feeling he was just going to come in the middle and lay down.
Yeah.
He's going to lay on the most inopportune thing.
Yeah.
Most opportune for him.
But that's like, fine. Yeah, that's fine.
Sorry, I didn't mean to
It's okay, Trevor. I know you
distract.
I know that you have, you know, your attention span is just very, very short.
It is.
It's fine. It's fine. But my biggest, one of the things that I take away from this game is the balance of like, you have these crazy set pieces versus like these emotional character arcs, which I find that to be really tricky. A tricky balance to do is like, so how do you, with all that craziness that Final Fantasy can be, this one still, I think manages to find a, like a balance between, emotional beats and, set pieces. So
it's a lot of humor too.
Yes. I think, so. Yeah, I would say there is a lot more humor than I had anticipated, especially from Kefka, who is supposed to be like one of the most diabolical characters in there, but it's like one of those things where you watch a villain on screen and it's like you just know that the person playing that character is like just really having a good time and who just likes being bad. And that's how I kind of view Kefka, is where this guy is just like, I'm just an asshole and I don't really care. And it's like, you know what, that fine, give me a reason to hate you for every other reason and for every reason that this game can present to me, because you seem to be enjoying what you're doing. And that's, in a weird way, it's like when a villain decides like, I'm going to be a villain, it's just like, that makes it all more enjoyable for me. Like I like that aspect a lot, even though it can be kind of hammy or cheesy. I really, really enjoy that. And I think from how they do it in a 2D sprite based game where the sprites are really, really small, but yet they're able to convey a lot of emotion with just key poses, key animation poses mixed, coupled in with a sound effect. And so it made me appreciate what the developers had to do to convey. You have these, what could be like an inch or two, maybe not an inch, but maybe a couple inches tall on screen, and to convey that emotion, that takes talent, man. Like that's what I gotta say.
Reminds me of Locke, where he like raises that little eyebrow and it's like 3 pixels long, but like you know exactly what it is.
So here's something crazy. I got this from that Pro Jared guy. Yeah. They did the sprites before they did the concept art.
Really?
What? They made the sprites first and then they were like, draw these people. That's insane.
Gogo's really weird then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because like, you look at the concept art, the Gogo kind of makes sense when you look at the concept art. When I see the sprite, I really don't really have a clue. I don't know what that is.
I see the cane. Doesn't he have the little cane thing?
Yeah,
like a staff or something. Yeah. Like that?
Staff. Well, maybe I'm thinking of Strago.
Strago has the cane or staff, but Gogo, the one who's like more like the mime slash who mimics your moves. Yeah, I don't know how you translate from sprite to an actual illustration. It's kind of bizarre because when I was looking on screen when the first time I was into this character, I had no idea who or what I was looking at. The Moogle I was completely familiar with because I'll probably get flack for this one, but it's from the I think I remember the Moogle most because it's not because of Final Fantasy. It's from Kingdom Hearts because Kingdom Hearts has this mixture of Final Fantasy characters and Disney characters too, and that's where the Moogle kind of came into the picture for me the most.
Yeah, you're right. He doesn't. I got the Strago thing mixed up.
Yeah. Look at that little thing, though.
Yeah.
Like, what am I looking at?
But kind of like once you get past the artwork in the menus and you see his eyes underneath.
Yeah, I always thought his eyes were up above. Like
the red part.
Yeah, the red part.
Yeah.
Which is like a hat or part of like.
Right. I thought he was just crazy.
Yeah.
Like just this monster, a crazy monster, when it's actually probably like a dude.
Yeah, or he's just got the little eyes down below. Because if you look at, there's the character artwork. You can zoom in, there you can see his eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I saw the illustration, I was like, oh, that's not exactly what I had envisioned at all. So that's interesting. That's a fun little fact that they worked backwards. I mean, I guess if they figured out the sprites first, then I guess that's an easier way of, trying to come up with a concept or illustration art for it.
I mean, it kind of shows that you're putting the thought of like what the game actually looks like first.
Mm-hmm. Right. Making the sprites work making the sprites the priority rather like instead of trying to fit the artwork inside of the sprites, right. You know, you can try, but it, you know, how good is it really going to look?
Especially at the time when you're on a 4x3 and then your maximum pixel count is 240p. That's
right.
That's crazy.
Well, and then if you look at all the prior Final Fantasy games, a lot of them, you know, you had the mages that all looked kind of the same up through even 5.
Right.
You know, the different jobs that you had in 5 and the different mages and how those looked. The ninjas looked relatively similar. Sometimes the knights had, you know, your traditional medieval looking armor. And then this game was kind of totally different when each character was totally different than these preconceived classes that had existed in pretty much every prior game.
I really liked the character design a lot because it was one of those things where you look at him and you go, yep, I know who exactly this is. I know what they're going to do. And that was one of the things, especially in the game, one of the things we haven't really touched upon is the Esperus, which is actually one of the central story focus.
Can we go back to characters?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, who was the character you were drawn to most?
Me? Probably Saban because he had the D-pad commands, and I liked the D-pad commands because that reminded me a lot of like Street Fighter that I played. And I also liked the fact that instead of just pressing a button and doing a move, I really liked felt like I was performing something and putting in the correct motion. But also I really liked his journey of what he was trying to become here. And
what character did you wish you would have liked, or that you're like, this character is my character, but then you realize,
yep. Fuck you. Sorry. Too,
oh, the cat.
Yeah. I kind of wish I liked Gal more, even though he had a really, he had a really good moment with his dad, but that was like the only thing that I experienced a good experience with. Otherwise, it's like he had all, especially from a character standpoint, it's like this character's just like kind of crazy off the chain, but I get that's why he's like that. But at the same time, his moveset, I honestly, I think that was like the one time where It's like, I honestly don't know what the fuck any of these really do. I never really got a good sense of what it was, but I felt like they're here for a reason and they're doing something when I click on it, but I'm like, I don't know what it does. It kind of felt lost.
It's a lot like Amaro, but you're just picking a fighting style and then he goes on his own thing. So hopefully you choose the right fighting style.
Right.
But he is one that you really have to grind with.
Amaro?
Yeah. No, I meant Gao.
Gao is like the one character where...
And you're not leveling him. You're just like out there and hoping that you're getting something new.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have to continue to fight around and hope that he just shows back up in a couple turns.
So yeah, it's like it's that the randomization of that character really was one of those things where I was like, I just don't really care, unfortunately. And it made me wish I did care more because he did have that moment. And I was like, and that's when I sat there thinking, I love this. I really love what I'm seeing right here. But in terms of gameplay, it's like, I don't care. It's like, this sucks. That I just really wish I liked playing him more because I felt like either the system didn't teach me that well or the system was in place and I somehow glossed over the nitty-gritty details of what does what.
Well, and I think once we talk about the Espers and magic, I'll bring up a point that I think is the biggest downside to Final Fantasy VI, but we'll get to that.
So, like, what were your answers?
I will say the one that I liked first was Shadow, because I always thought, you know, just mysterious assassin. I was like, oh, that's a cool guy. I really like
just him. Chucks things.
Just chucks things. Yeah, you get a sweet sword. Or did you ever like save the game and then you chuck the Ultima is it the Ultima sword?
Yeah.
Chuck the Ultima sword and it's like, no. That's it. I would save the game and be like, oh, let's chuck all these like really like these one time swords and just see what happens and, you know, get the 9999 quad 9.
Oh,
you know,
nice.
And then that's it. I never saved it. You know, I reverted and reset the game. But it was just like, let's throw that sword and this sword and that sword.
I never did that because I never wanted a chance of like me fucking up and forgetting that I did that. I was like, that was probably a bad idea.
I was hoping that Mog would have been cooler.
Right? That was one that I thought was so cool that like nostalgia for me.
Yeah.
I thought Mog was going to be amazing. And then when I played it this time around, I was super disappointed.
Yeah.
I didn't get very many of his dances either.
Right, right. And there was that one that you had to get in the World of Balance on the Serpent River.
Oh.
There was only one. I think that was one of the only places you could get it. Maybe there was a way to get in the World of Ruin.
Wow. Because I got Mog in the World of Ruin. Like I somehow...
Right? Couldn't you do...
I don't remember, man.
Now I'm starting to second guess myself.
Like, I wasn't sure because there was like no particular order because I felt like the World of Balance, I felt like it was kind of a little bit more streamlined.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to the World of Ruin, it wasn't as...
It's a lot more sandboxy, like where you're wandering around
and yeah,
like who you run into when.
Right. And that was all kind of like all what felt like by chance sort of thing. But all the characters, I think, they're not randomized. They're in set locations for mm-hmm. story beats. But even at the time when I was playing it, I felt like I was still I was roaming around quite a bit looking for all these characters that I, after kind of like the climactic, what it would be like a mid-season finale or something like that when you're on the floating rock or island or whatever and fighting, you do have a battle and where the Espers get released off into the world and everything starts going to shit. And I was like, that was another cool moment, by the way. I was like, I really like this finale feel that's going on. I know it's not the end of the game, but then after that, it's really quiet. And basically you have these characters going through these sets of emotions, like the repercussions of what just happened. And it's like another time where a game is really allowing you to absorb what had just transpired. And back again, 1994, I'm pretty sure there was not something at the time that met that was at that level of equivalency right there. To me, that's like... I don't know. I don't want to say revolutionary, but it was definitely, I'll say it was daring. It felt very daring in that time frame. And now when I look back at it now, I go, nah, yeah, this all makes sense to me now. But I have to remember, 1994, 2D, no, man, no shit. Like, there's no way. Like, that's a gamble, especially in the Western market.
All right. Kind of, go ahead.
There is a way to get Mog in the World of Balance.
What?
You go back to Narsh.
Right.
And you go up to where Terra, the opening scene where Terra and the Magitek armor, you can get Mog up there because he's being held hostage by Lone Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get him from there and you can get him in your party.
Wow.
And that's where the Water Harmony dance is the only way you can get it in the Serpent Trench. And you have to do that in the World of Balance because the Serpent Trench goes away in World of Ruin.
Interesting. I did not know that. See, that's a... man.
Sorry, there's a bunch of these little things that I've just, you know, as I got older, I was like, oh, there's all these other little things I want to go back and do. And
but even if you... Let me ask you this then. I think that brings up another question. Even if you miss those things, do you feel like you're missing out?
As a completionist, 100%.
Okay. Now...
Because you can never get that 100%.
Right. You can never go back and get that.
All right.
Which was that's another interesting thing as I play like Breath of the Wild or a couple other games where I'm like, oh, if I don't get this and save it, I'll never be able to get it again. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, okay, there are ways I can go back and get some OP swords in
right.
Breath of the Wild.
Right.
Sort of thing. You can't do that. You can't do that in Final Fantasy VI. There's a couple of those instances. Do you ever do the curse shield into the paladin shield? You pick up the curse shield in Narsh.
Right. Yeah, back in the day I did. Because I had the book back in the day.
And it did like damage to you or something like the whole time?
Yeah. You had like all the like horrible statuses. And then after 255 fights, it would turn into the paladin shield. And then you could learn Ultima off of it.
I think so, yeah.
So you equip the paladin shield. And after 99 AP, or was it AP? Is that the magic points? MP?
Yeah, MP.
MP, you would get Ultima. So no, that was...
I remember thinking to myself, I know there's a reason behind this, but right now, like I still didn't know. I didn't know at the time until I looked it up as to what... I didn't know what reward you would reap from it until I looked it up until I, you know, finishing the game and was like, oh, that's interesting. I don't know if I would have wanted to take that route because I've gotten Ultima from an Esper, and that for me was, you know, one of the times where I was intentionally grinding. Because I was like, I like this move. One of my characters has this move, and I want another character just to have it so that for some reason, if the final climactic battle...
if you just want to blow up the world.
You just want right? basically have a move set for characters that I know that are really good, but I want them to have like a, you know, an ace up their sleeve sort of thing. Just in case. And I did that with a couple characters. I had like three characters who had that special move.
That's it?
Yeah.
You only had three characters that had Ultima?
Yeah. Because
my like top eight had Ultima. My top eight had Ultima, Life 3, Cure 3.
Cure 3?
Probably it.
Cure 3.
Fire 3. Probably like Fire 3, Bolt 3, and Ice 3.
See, my
top eight characters. So I had
a lot of Cure 3s. Only one or no, two had Life 3. A lot of them had Life 2, which was really...
Oh, Life 2. No, Life 2. You're right. Life 2 was the better one.
Yeah, Life 3, what happened with Life 3 is that...
That's right.
If you died during battle, you would just automatically get revived.
Yeah. Sorry, Life 2.
So right. Life 3 was amazing in my opinion. Like,
I didn't use it that much.
I didn't either because I could not tell... I don't remember because when I would use it at times when... I didn't die, so I didn't know if it was just one turn related or if it lasted the whole battle. I didn't know that part. So,
sure. Did you know that if you took in Narsh, and this wasn't where the curse shield was, in Narsh where you can take the rock that guy sees and he's like, do you want to turn it into the Esper or do you want to turn it into a sword?
I don't remember this.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
You could turn it into the Illumina sword, or you could turn it into the Ultima. What was the Esper? What was the Esper?
Just Ultima?
Was that Ultima?
I don't remember that at all.
What was the Esper that had Ultima?
I think I might have chose the Esper.
Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Ragnarok.
I got the Esper.
So you could... So the other way to get Ultima was through the Paladin Shield.
Right.
So like
I was not dealing with that shit.
Right. Yeah. Because it was you had to grind that and grind and grind. And then it took a while to get Ultima finally after you ground 255 battles with the Curse Shield. And
see, that I think that was my threshold. That was a threshold. I was like, I was not willing to endure because the random encounters were still kind of, especially near the latter half of the game. I felt like I had a lot more than the beginning part of the game for some reason. It just felt like every two steps battle. It's like, Jesus Christ, I can't even walk across this fucking world right now.
I remember in college grinding and like falling asleep at the controller. Uh-huh. You guys were like fall asleep playing.
Yep.
So you were grinding your controller? Is that what you just
said? I was totally grinding my controller.
Oh, God.
I was grinding and I'd just be sitting on the couch and I'd just fall asleep and be like, what am I doing? And that's probably at the point where I was like, all right, I'm done playing this game. And like, Justin, you just stop.
That's unfortunate, though.
Then you're like 4/5 of the way through the game.
Yeah, exactly. I would get to Dinosaur Island and be like, all right, I'm going to get Ultima and like at least 6 characters, Cure 3. And I would put like, I would battle with one person that had 9,999 health, and then the other person would just be like this lowly like schlub trying to get them like all the magic as possible. So then that way I could grind their magic up in like 10 battles or 20 battles.
Mm-hmm. While the other person is just doing all the work.
And then you'd get in a Brachiosaur and they would cast Ultima or whatever, and then you'd be done. You're like, I should have saved the game, but I didn't save the game. So now I just lost, 30 minutes of gameplay trying to grind this out.
That's fun. Well, speaking of Espers, another thing I wanted to...
Let's just distract them and not get the Espers.
Yeah, the Espers.
It's because it's like your last name.
Michael Esper. Yeah, Michael Esper. Well, the one thing about that I think really helps change the game is that before acquiring Espers in this game, which are basically magical rocks, essentially, that once you have them equipped, they have a certain set of magical attributes that you can, or moves, excuse me, that a character can utilize. And also, each Esper has like an overall type of, I guess you would say, call of attack, or, it can help generate health. And it has like a buff of some sort that can help the whole team. So that means that characters who are not magical oriented can have magical powers. And so before having Espers is that like the character Locke, I hated using Locke at that like very early on the stage because I'm like, man, this guy's just getting his ass whooped all the time. Mm-hmm.
And you're just using like a dagger.
Yeah, then that's it. Like,
really?
Barely.
Yeah, I did not care for him that much. But
he was usually like my top 5, really? Top 6.
I mean, once Saban got into the mix, man, it's like who? Basically, he's a one man army. Like,
what's your top 4? Like, if you had to go, like, if you had to choose today, what four are you roaming the world with?
Celeste.
Okay.
Cyan.
Okay.
It's a mix between Edgar and Locke and Terra.
Wow, Saban didn't make the top 4.
Saban's up there. I think Saban's in the top 4, but Locke, Edgar, and Terra were kind of interchangeable to me. The reason Cyan was up there, did you guys ever use the Genji glove on him?
Yeah.
So if you did the Quadra Slice, whatever that other one is.
Yeah.
And you had him at a high level, you could get 8 quad nines out of him.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah. So that was like my thing with him is...
Quadra Slice was my favorite of him.
Right. That's the number 8 level of his sword tech.
I think it's 7, actually. The 8 one.
Oh, that's right.
It was number 7. 4 and 7 are very identical.
Right.
But 7 does a lot more damage. 8 was like this like powerful like
it was the one hit one the like demi hit
like
number and it failed sometimes or did he if he got hit he would do the demi hit
yeah anything. Yeah so the number 8 was like a really like a charge up attack where you just kind of like fly up in the air and slash down and but the problem with that one is that I felt like I failed way too many times to, like I waited too long for this move and then it's like oh by chance you failed it's like
I just waited 10 minutes for this bar to load.
right so that's why you put the Genji glove he can equip two swords
right
and so each slice go
yeah see so here's the thing I did not do that with him I did that with Shadow because I felt like even though he was throwing stuff a lot and his dog would randomly attack at
Interceptor
a really high attack damage may I add I just felt like where I didn't feel like going through all that shit and be like I'm just gonna throw stuff and just hope it does some damage but the weapons he had like what I had equipped with him I was like you know what let's just him just go blop blop you know a couple times and
see it, that's why I feel like Cyan was a better fit because just the quadra slice or quadra slash.
Oh, it makes more sense now.
Yeah.
Totally does.
But you could use the shurikens, which were kind of cool. If you had some AoE stuff going on.
Yeah. The shurikens were nice. Very nice touch. And then like near the end of the game where I can't remember which character died, but it was just like by some dumb luck from like Kefka just completely... I think he annihilated Sabin like near like from like third like right before the last bit. Like I was really doing a good job managing keeping them alive, but somehow I can't remember what movie he did, but he just completely wiped him out. I was like, you motherfucker. Just
what about top four for you?
Oh, Sabin, Celeste, Amaro.
Are you serious?
I loved Amaro.
Amaro was like Number 14. No, dude. I never used him.
Really?
Because he had the bone club or whatever, and that was his only weapon or whatever, right?
He'd throw people
or he'd just like go and attack. Like
I never used
him. I kind of just love the randomness of it. Like
I wish I would have, but so, I just never did.
I will argue in favor of Amaro because even though he was random attacks, those attacks
were insanely.
They're insanely high, dude.
What?
I never. He
just picks up a character and chucks it at what? The enemy. Oh my god! So, dude, much damage.
I'm gonna tell you. I'm gonna tell you from this experience here. Anytime he threw someone, I was never below 5,000 damage. It was always 5,000 or higher. Anytime he threw someone, it was some serious damage. So that was the one thing I go. Where you have characters who have that random effect, but their random effect, in this case for that Yeti, he did some serious damage. And I was like, he threw Shadow at this one character and completely annihilated him in one hit. And I remember sitting there being stunned and dumbfounded to go like, wait, what just happened? What just happened here? And the match, like the battle was over. I'm like, okay.
My mind is blown.
So to
my
reference, mind is blown. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Wild card,
you
baby.
You have to have the brains. You have to have the brawn. You have to have the looks. And then wild card, bitches. And that's what Amaro is. He's the wild card that kicked everyone's ass.
Oh my gosh. I don't know what to think.
Put a bolo tie on him.
What about you? Your top four, Mike?
For me, top four, definitely Celeste, Sabin, Cyan, and I also...
Cyan was my fourth, by the way.
I also kind of gotten a liking... I wouldn't know, like, but she's really close. I was going to add Realm to the mix, but I really liked her ability to paint the opponent and that opponent's move would do that damage to that opponent. Now, sometimes it didn't work in my favor, but I really like that concept of how
it's an ice character and then you attack it with ice. And
yeah. Like that, HP. that didn't right, work out right. So well, but I really I enjoyed her, her presence more than I would have anticipated. But for an actual fourth, I think it'd just be like the original crew that even Terra from the very beginning, I really enjoyed her, I really enjoyed all those four. And I think it's kind of, I feel like that's really basic as you can get when you come to a top four, but they're really strong characters.
Bottom four for me. Bottom four.
Oh, God.
Go-Go.
Okay.
Umaru. Mm. Strago.
Okay.
And Realm.
Ah.
Maybe Gao down in there. But I just, they came so late in the game. I wasn't as emotionally attached and invested. And
I think I don't know if I would put Gao at the bottom, but he's close to the bottom. But I wouldn't say at the very bottom, but Go-Go definitely bottom. Mog, unfortunately, bottom. I would probably put, yeah, definitely Strago and maybe. You know what? I didn't really care for Setzer that much.
I wanted to really like Setzer.
Setzer was, yeah, he was bottom four for me. When I was a kid, loved it, right?
Yeah.
It's like the closest thing you get to gambling.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And now, like, I'm just playing it. I'm like, God, I just kind of hate this. Like, just give me sevens. Like, just give me something that's good. And, like, I'm not trying to go for, I don't know, what any of the other good things were anymore.
Yeah, I was not as invested in that character at all.
All right. So, we're talking bottom four. Who are your bottom two that you did not take to the last thing?
Go-Go and Maru.
Go-Go and Mog.
I'm pretty sure I left out I left out Mog and Realm.
Oh.
I had heard people having really good success with Go-Go.
You got Go-Go right after Sabin, and with the attack time whole thing, like where you can structure who's going after who. Like I can just do
Mimic and
You mimic his
bum rush. Blitz,
his bum rush, yeah. So you'd get two bum rushes right after each other. That is like Go-Go. I was pretty big on just for that reason alone. And then he's also like a good one to like be able to heal people or whatever, which is mainly
because
like,
it would be a free. It'd be. Did he use magic if he did the mimic?
I think you could do magic aside from mimic.
Right, you could do that, but if you did mimic like
if you mimic
three,
yeah.
Did he use magic?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
I couldn't remember.
Yeah, Amaro was one of those characters you cannot modify at all. He was just a pretty much a animal, well, just an animal, and I was totally fine with that. And I was not really good with my structuring of characters. In fact, I'm still a little dumb when it comes to like why does it say defense for these characters. I still have not even put in 60 hours into that.
I never did any of the line changes or I think it had good intention.
Yeah, it's a really neat idea. Just
like the defense thing would be like, did you ever play with it at all?
I never once did.
So the idea would be is if somebody was really weak and wasn't doing well in the battle, you could put somebody stronger on defense and they would run out in front of them and take the attack.
Oh.
Which, like, if you got the right ring on, then they'd do anyway. So I'd throw, ring was. That, like, I'd put it on Sabin or Cyan, and they'd help defend the other people anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I never did that. Just didn't see at the time. Like, I just, it was a... aspect that I did not, I didn't learn. I didn't feel like the game taught me that. I wasn't sure if I overlooked something in that regard. Maybe it was in the very beginning of the battles with the tech armor and Terra along with the soldiers, but I never fully grasped it. But that did not deter my experience from the game alone. So that's how to say about it.
I thought magic was kind of the downside of Final Fantasy VI.
Really?
Oh yeah. Reveal of like what?
Yeah, because what sucks about it? At some point your special character abilities become moot, in my opinion. Once you learn magic, all I'm doing is Ultima and sword attacks. That was just how I played.
Mm-hmm.
Ultima and sword attacks. That's it. That's all I did.
What about Cyan with the Genji glove and the quad attack?
That was probably the extent of it. And maybe Sabin, if I had Sabin up there as a top four.
You know, Terra and her morph ability.
Garbage.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it did. Was it supposed to make it stronger?
Make
it
made stronger? Her spell stronger?
Yeah, it's supposed to make it a little bit stronger, but at some point, you know, quad nine is all you can get.
Yeah, you know? And it didn't last that long for me. Like, I don't know why. I don't know how I made that form last longer. But
like, I never used Celeste's rune abilities.
Oh, I did quite a bit.
Runic? I used
it. Yeah, runic? I never used it.
Oh, man.
Because I just gave her the Ultima Sword or the Illumina Sword and just quad nines. Okay. And
so I would say because...
So you play offense hardcore is what I'm finding.
That's what it felt like the world of Rune became after a certain point. After you get everybody, it's like, all right, now you just build, you know, a cannon.
Sure. Team. Sure. I would say that I was still, because of my newbie-ness, that I did not have... I just did not know, so...
Sure. How many hit points did your top player have?
Hit points? Oh, I think I was just under 5 grand.
That's crazy. I would always get my characters up to like 8. I would always have somebody that was 9999, quad nines.
That's amazing.
I'm a psychopath. That's why maybe I got so tired, because I just grind and be like, all right, I got to get at least 2 characters up to 8K. And then everybody else has to be at least 6K. And then 5 and 6 in the slot will be kind of my backup. And I would just roll through Kefka.
You're still rolling through with your top 4. No one even died. No. You're like 5 stages.
Because I knew Fallen One was coming. So I would have somebody ready to cast Cure 3 or use a Mega Elixir. And then I'd be back up to 999. For my top 2, and then, you know, maybe they weren't 999 in the top 2, but maybe that's why I didn't like Magic, because I was just like, well, I'll just roll through with Ultima and win the game.
Well, I didn't have that.
But like, you're saying that you didn't like the Magic, you think Magic is the downside, but you're talking about that's all you're using.
But and maybe that's because that was my play style, is that I feel like Magic took away from the abilities of certain characters, like Mog's Dance, garbage. Gawu, garbage, in my opinion. Maru, garbage. Gogo, garbage. A lot of these characters I thought were just garbage characters. Setzer, garbage. Yeah. Strago, garbage. All these players were just like garbage. Steel.
Yeah.
Was cool when you were like, all right, let's put 2 characters on them. Let's get the speed boots or whatever gives him his fastest thing and try and steal from a Cactrot.
Yeah,
in the desert, or no? Was it a Cactrot, or was it a Cactrot, or there were 2 other sand creatures that would kill themselves, and you had to be really fast, and you could steal Mega Elixirs from them if you got lucky.
I did not know this. I don't think I wandered around the desert as much as
I looked it up in guides and stuff. Okay, so I'm the scrub that was like, all right, let's look them up.
So like this time, I tried not to use guides.
Okay,
I did use them so I could figure out how to get Shadow again.
Yeah.
That was at the Coliseum, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was because you had to like offer a specific weapon.
Right. Right, you're right. Yeah, that's I had to use a guide for that one.
Other than that, I used it a couple more times when I was like stuck on like
the Phoenix Cave.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
What a beast. I loved it though. What a great idea. 2 parties.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You're gonna get wrecked because it's really hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, then the last stage is 3, and I love that. And I mean, that's what, like, you have to have, there's 14 characters. You have to have at least 12 strong ones. Pretty strong.
There's at least 6 strong ones that carry all 3 parties. Okay. And then...
I mean, so your top 4, you're splitting up between 3 parties, for yeah,
pretty much. So then when you go through and you fight the sub-bosses and... in the tower
right.
Before you get to the statues.
See, I made sure that everyone and their mother had a cure ability. That was my go-to.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Everyone had to have a cure ability, with the exception of Umaru, who wasn't allowed magic. But other than that, everyone's like, okay, you're at least getting a cure too right now. At least you're getting that, because that will still... get you a decent amount of health back.
Maybe I need to play the game again and play with like less grindy, less like I gotta be OP as much as possible.
You need to just hit the point where you're like, wonder if I can defeat Kefka, and just try it.
Right. I probably need to, because like I said, I would spend hours on Dinosaur Island Just so, like, all right, this night I'll go to Dinosaur Island and go grind out Ultima Cure 3 and Tri-Touch and get the three fire, ice, and...
Right.
Jesus Christ.
And, dude, like, I did that a lot, too, but I wasn't near what you had. I don't even remember what they were, but I guarantee I was not rocking 9999.
Yeah, I would always get one character to quad nines, and then that would be the person that would level everybody up. And there was a rune, a relic that you could put on that would give a boost to XP. So your XP would be a multiplier. So you could get your XP. Maybe no. It was a relic that would allow you to get more hit points per level.
When you XP'd?
When you leveled.
Oh yeah.
And same thing with magic. So there was like this deep like grindiness that like
Mike's no. So continue on, and I'll touch upon something that an experience that I never had. So go ahead.
Yeah, because you could if you looked at some of those relics and you really dove deep into it, you could get a couple that would help get you the max hit points as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. So I'd do that and then do the... Was there a magic point one where you get double magic points or winning or something like that? Probably. Maybe I can't remember. Or maybe I'm thinking that you got the Brachiosaur and you got the really good high amount of magic points. So that's where like...
That's a bad one to have with Gal because he'll like randomly throw Ultima out there. and then you just wiped your entire party.
Right. So... Yeah, that was kind of my experience a lot of times, unfortunately. That's why I would stop playing. I'd only beat it maybe two or three times.
So before closing, I wanted to say something.
We're not closing.
Yeah. Trevor? So what I wanted to bring up is that what I'm seeing right now, what I'm witnessing, is what I witnessed on the playground during elementary school. Because I had a lot of friends who had a Super Nintendo at the time, and they played Legend of Zelda, they played I've caught wind of Final Fantasy VI, and I would hear discussions about details of what they did the night before looking for certain items or talking about strategies or tactics. Never had that experience when I was a kid because of, I owned a Sega Genesis and a lot of my stuff was beat 'em up, side scrolls, you name it, like I mentioned earlier.
There weren't a whole lot of Sonic Tactics?
No, yeah, not at all. There was like Fantasy
Run Faster?
I don't remember.
Jump
higher. I don't think it's Fantasy
Pinball. Star. There was that Sonic Pinball game.
Oh, yeah, I played that too.
True.
So
it was great.
But yeah.
Spinball.
Yeah, Spinball, excuse me. But what I'm hearing right here and experiencing, because I was just cheesing because I'm like, I did not get to have this during the times, as a child. I watched my other friends have it, and I thought they were silly for doing that, but of course it's video games, so it's like, oh, you just want to listen to them and see what they're talking about and kind of feel involved and feel like maybe you're part of something here. And that was the communal aspect that I never got.
You wish you had Twitch back then.
I don't know, Bob. I wish I had Twitch back then, but I wish I did have, I felt like I was part of a community, to so to speak. And it's the same thing with, I'm not sure, but when Fez came out at the time, that was very much a communal type of game because there were not much of any guides at all. It was a community trying to figure out these puzzles, these very elaborate puzzles, and they would go on forums and talk about how they figured it out. And that was, it kind of encompassed what Fez was about. It was, it was about a life journey, just figuring things out on your own. Cause there's no like really health or bar, no health or anything. There's nothing time sensitive about it. You're just going out exploring, collecting these, 32 cubes or 64 cubes, hint, hint, 32 bit, 64 bit. Anyway, and that type of thing that wasn't really involved in the forums, but I got to read them and just kind of read like how, people figured out certain areas of the world, the levels, call them what you will. Same thing with here. Like, I'm watching Trevor geek out about how, you know, certain tactics he used, and you're talking about what your experience with that. And it's like, oh, I never knew that. And, you know, I consider you two the veterans among this. So seeing that genuine interaction is very enlightening. It's very heartening to see. I would say not enlightening, but heartening. Enlightening is not the right word, but it's very heartening to see, because I did not have that. And I, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, wow, I finally get that. Personally, I finally get that experience. And I think that's totally cool.
Well, and I think it was a different time where you had GamePro Magazine and Nintendo Power. And that was your main source. If you didn't have internet and you weren't familiar with game FAQs, or if you didn't have an online chat group that you could go to talk about these things, like, you had to buy those magazines or buy the guide, you know, the official, you know, guide to get through all that, which we did a lot, because I was a completionist as a kid, as much as I could be.
I only had a handful of games, so I had the guide just be like that completionist, but also just like playing the hell out of the same couple of games.
And there would be little things like I would hear throughout the years of like the Mog thing. You could get Mog in the World of Balance, but in order to get the dance, you had to go through and do this. Or Gao could only get certain you could get World of Balance enemies in the Veldt. Anyway, so it was I loved that aspect, and that's the nostalgia aspect that I really, really rely heavily on. But at the same time, the world building and character building in this game was one, revolutionary, and two, stands the test of time.
For sure. I mean, every character has their own individual personality, which is really, really hard if you have in like five or six characters. There's 14. Yeah. Granted, a lot of them don't talk.
True.
Or say very few. But at the same time, like, Gogo and Amaro aren't really talking, but they have very different feels. Just even when they're hanging around your airship.
During the airship or even in battle, you still kind of get a sense of who they are. And that's, I don't know, like, that's tough. I feel like that's a tough thing to accomplish. And if you can do that with your characters not talking that much, or if at all, and still get a sense of who they are during even gameplay battle, that's, I still think, in a way, you're getting an idea of who they are as a character, even though there's very little dialogue exchange. And that's, again, it's a very hard thing to do, and it's not very easy. And it's one of those things where I sit there and go, I cannot knock this. Like, this is pretty fucking good that you can do this in 1994 2D. That's even more impressive. It's impressive from some of the games I even played. They're more modern games, man. So in my final remarks, like, this is like one of those games where I'm very happy I played it, and I do want to do another run through eventually down the road. But getting off that and just let me like savor what I experienced and having this conversation with you two, that to me, like, it's one of those times where, yes, I do think it stands the test of time. It is all worth the hype that people make it out to be. And it's not just because it's 2D or 16-bit or anything like that. Like, that was just the style at the time of how to make video games. And that caught, there is no hindrance to, it never hindered the gameplay at all. Like, the gameplay was not bound to any sort of graphical aspect to it at all, because then you still had 3D ass games still utilizing the same type of gameplay mechanic. So they tell me, like, it wasn't a graphical thing. It was just it's a gameplay thing. So it's still somehow surpassed 2D, and now we're into 3D and still used to this very day. So it's like, they did something right. I mean, I have a hard time believing they didn't. So Final Fantasy VI is, I understand why it's your favorite game, Trevor. When we talked about Chrono Trigger, and I'm right there with you. It is probably one of the best RPGs I have played to date, and I highly recommend, if you can, whatever way you can play it, I know there's been iterations of it in terms of platforms, but I highly recommend anybody who can have the time to play it, I'd do it. Heartbeat. Justin, what about you, sir?
It goes a lot faster if you can fast forward.
Is that like an iOS or Android game?
I know it is on the Play Store.
Okay.
I may or may not have used an emulator.
Because I have the emulated version, the Game Boy Advance emulated version on my phone, which is a different translation.
Different. Okay. No, I had an SNES emulator on it.
They took the Game Boy Advance translation and put it on the SNES version.
Oh, weird.
So I played through some of that.
Whenever I see stills of that, I'm like, whoa, like all the sprite designs are so different.
From the Game Boy Advance version?
Yeah. They're so much more round.
Yeah.
They look more, for lack of a better term, Nintendo-ish.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I don't know. You guys are making me want to play this again.
Yeah.
I don't know. It is one of my favorite games that I have ever played, and I will definitely play it again at some point in my life, if only for the story. I think that this is one of the first games that really combined kind of the steampunk idea before steampunk was really a thing. And the combination of using magic as a form of energy and as a form of power in a world that's kind of had its second industrial revolution. Is, or maybe it's their first industrial revolution. It's hard to tell since it's not the same world as ours. But it has really stood out to me for that reason. And I don't know, all the individual characters, all the interplay just between like even Edgar and Sabin, how they feel very much like brothers,
mm-hmm.
and the quasi love stories between like Locke and Celeste. I don't know. It seems like it's a very long, very good movie that I would be thrilled to revisit again.
I think for me, the nice thing is as I get older and I'm able to digest things a little bit more, especially through later playthroughs, you start picking up on those intricacies of the love stories, the emotions, the themes that really tie a lot of it together. I mean, you look at All Hope Is Lost through the first world of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, we're going to do it. We're going to beat the Empire. And then all of a sudden, Kefka and Gestal, right? Emperor Gestal?
I think so, yeah.
Go through and they get the...
is it Magicite or the Espers? Or
yeah, they get the Espers and the portal. What was the name of that place that they go through? The Realm of the Espers or whatever it is?
Yeah, I can't think of what it is. Where they have like those Magicite statues and all that.
Yeah. And then you're like, oh, we just lost. And then you go back into an even deeper hole of despair where people are like joining cults. There are people who want to kill themselves. There are people who are lost. There's all this different negativity and downside, and everybody's just trying to grasp.
And the world that you had already went through, you went all over this world, and it's broken now. And it's literally called the World of Ruin.
It's broken even more.
This weird, like, U-shape thing.
Right. You lose your airship. How are you going to get around? But then you get these stories that interact with how and why and... It just gets me excited that like they did this in 94 on however big the cartridge was, with such, you know, development time was a year.
Right. That's insane.
A year. They did Final Fantasy V, went right into development for Final Fantasy VI in a year. And it was, you know, a smash hit. So just the nostalgia, the feelings, the emotions, the connections, I think nothing. I haven't had an experience that really says, yeah, this is the complete package. This Final Fantasy VI is pretty close, but nothing near touches it, in my opinion.
I remember this was probably like my second playthrough of this game because I didn't finish my first time, but I remember being in like sixth grade and what you were saying, that there were people talking about it and everything. I remember being the kid that went to school to talk about this. And no one else gave a shit except for like three of my friends.
Yeah, yeah. I had a couple friends who had older brothers who gave a shit about the game. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, I watched my brother play this. Or, and I got to play a little bit. But there was probably maybe one or two of us in my school that just knew about it.
I wish I had it, but now I got it now, which is even better, which is, I feel like it's even more sweeter now. And right. With that said, I thank you two for joining me on this adventure and talking about Final Fantasy VI. We do hope the listeners do check this out, and when the remastered edition is probably going to be the most accessible version of it. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of hubbub and backlash because I'm sure it's not going to look as pretty as the other, as the original. When has a remastered of a 16-bit sprite game looked that good? I mean, The Secret of Mana got a lot of shit for it, so that's a whole thing too. But it does look, that one does look pretty bad. That looked awful. With that said, anyway, thank you two for coming on the show.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Trevor, I'll try not to keep you always in the 2D 16-bit camp all the time, but I just know that is your, I know that's your cup of tea.
That's my bread and butter.
I know it is, man. I know it. I don't blame you. I don't know what's next on the list. I did finish Breath of the Wild, at least the main storyline of Breath of the Wild, and I'm going back and finding all the shrines and all and doing all that stuff, which is pretty cool. But then I am currently playing, started getting back more into Kingdom Hearts 3. However, I'm willing to actually hop right, you know, start right into that episode because my short version, not to sound pretty pompous or full of myself, but I will say that I grew up, but that game did not grow up. There are some things that they do in that current game now that I go, you know what? This was great then, but it's not bad now. It's just okay. And I played other games that have done things better. I feel like I've done things better and just did not, it feels kind of samey ultimately. And do a deeper dive into that when that time comes. So yeah, I don't know what's next. I apologize about that, but
and I feel like that almost speaks to the testament of this game in a way,
right?
Because if you have these multiple series of games, mm-hmm. right, and you have potentially the same people working on them, like coming up with new ideas and coming up with sequels or mm-hmm. coming up with a trilogy or a quadrilogy or whatever, it's getting harder and harder. You're like scraping the bottom of the barrel. This is the sixth edition of this game, and it is arguably the best version.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how many Final Fantasies right now there are there?
There's 15. Like
15 right now? Yeah.
And one was an two of them were MMOs. Them.
Yeah, 14 right now.
Which ones have you played?
Final Fantasies?
Yeah.
1, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And that's where I stopped. I didn't play any of the PlayStation 2 ones. I didn't play 9 either. They got back to the job system, and I was like, eh.
Oh,
yeah. Not that I was against it now, but at the time, I was just like, I don't want a job system.
I don't want a gerb.
I don't want a gerb.
Okay.
I got it, and then part of that was I got into Counter-Strike really big at that point, so.
Explains it all. Well, thank you two for joining, and thank you those to listening. And we'll be back with another one on the list. I got a list, and we'll see what comes next. No promises or anything, but thank you for tuning in, and we're peacing out. Bye.
Later.